Thank you for coming to Einstein Fest and in particular to the Theater of Ideas for our next presentation. My name is John Matlock. I am the Director of Administration here at Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to introduce your next speaker. Before I do that, I would like to mention that while there's opportunity to interact through the lecture with Damien, we will at the end of the talk provide microphones which will be passed around the audience. So should any of you have a question, we'll be asking you to stand up and speak clearly into the mic so that everybody can benefit from hearing the question at the same time. And that will be at the end of the lecture. Okay, with that, I'll introduce Damien Pope. Damien is Perimeter Institute's Director of Scientific Outreach. Damien was born in Melbourne, Australia, and at a very early age began to play with mathematics and equations. He grew up and turned on to modern physics as a career choice by reading popular books, particularly on a subject known as quantum mechanics. Damien went on to earn his PhD in physics from the University of Queensland and became a scientist in a specialized field known as quantum information theory. Concurrent with his research in that area, Damien had opportunity to provide talks in Australia to the general public and in fact became somewhat of a science spokesperson on national television in Australia, and this all culminated in another degree in science communications. His unique combination as a researcher and teacher brought him to Perimeter Institute, where, not coincidentally, the twin mandates here are scientific research excellence and educational outreach. As the Director of Scientific Outreach, Damien is not only responsible for many of the scientific exhibits and apparatus in the Physica Fantastica tent that you see, but he also conducts teacher workshops and in-class lectures right across Canada. He is also responsible for coordinating and teaching science camps here at the Institute, most notably the International Summer School for Young Physicists and the Einstein National Teachers Workshop here at the Institute. On a personal note, I can tell you that Damien is just a terrific guy to have around the office. He is a real gentleman and a lot of fun to have around. He's a fitness buff. He recently completed the Toronto Half Marathon a week or so ago. He likes to do something called bushwalking, which means hiking here in Canada. And he plays in the uniquely Australian sport of unicycle field hockey, but has yet to find a team here in Canada. So everyone, please welcome Damien Pope.
Thank you very much, John. Okay, this is working? Great. So what I would like to do is, first of all, thank you for coming along this afternoon for this talk. And during the next hour or so, I'd like to tell you, well, the title is Einstein Inside Out. And the subtitle is The Curious Case of Albert E. And so one thing that defined Einstein that was central to him and his life, he was a very, very curious person, right, from a young boy up till the very last day of his life. And he asked a lot of questions. And those questions led him to very, very interesting places and to discover lots of interesting things that are still very relevant to every single person here today. So what I hope to do is really talk about Einstein. That's better. Einstein the person, some of the discoveries he made about stars, about the world around us, space, time, and energy, and where they've actually led us to. And while Albert is very, very relevant to everyone today, but I'm actually going to need some help to that. And every good scientist needs an assistant. So I'd like to introduce you to my assistant here. He's very, very shy, so you'll just have to bear with him. So this is Beaker here. Beaker, audience Beaker. Okay, so Beaker will be helping me out a bit later on, so I'll just set him up there. He's very quiet, he might not talk very much at all, but Beaker will help me. So, as I said before, one thing that was crucial to Einstein, one thing that really he did a lot of, was being very curious and asking a lot of questions. And look at, in particular, in 1905, maybe some of you saw the displays out there, when he was 26 years old, he made a lot of discoveries about the world, about fundamental things about the world around us, about time, about space and distance around us, and about energy. And while they may kind of seem like abstract things, they're fundamental to everything in the physical world. And Once you understand how they work and you have a greater idea, that allows you, I guess, power to build new objects and new technologies and new devices. And we'll look at some examples of those. And we'll end up with Albert's impact today in 2005. Now, Albert was so curious in a way when it came to things in nature, you could say that he's like a detective. So he kind of will... So one thing that Albert was very curious about at school, that's actually a school photo of Albert there. Does anyone know which one Albert is in the photo? Yes. This one? Go down? There? Absolutely right. And congratulations, well done. Now, I did actually bring some prizes in, and I bought some chocolate Toblerone bars. And the reason I did it, actually, there's a scientific reason for that, because actually for a while early on in his life, Albert worked as something called a patent clerk. And that might sound like a fancy name, but he was a person that kind of approved and looked at new inventions and discoveries. And one of the inventions and discoveries he actually approved and looked at was the Toblerone chocolate bar. So I have a whole box of these I was going to give out, but then I thought, well, you probably wouldn't want those because this is a scientific sort of presentation, so a scientific conference. So I thought I'd come up with an even better idea. So I've got some original German papers, translations, well, actually original German papers of Einstein's papers from 1905. So could if you just pass that up the back there to that. Would you prefer the Einstein or the chocolate? Chocolate? Okay, I think it was a chocolate unanimous. If you could just... Where are you? Who was it? Great, there you go. And your name?
Ayush.
Ayush. Well, everyone give Ayush a round of applause. Okay. Maybe I kind of misjudge kids today. Okay. So what I'd like to do, one thing that Albus was very curious about was a compass. So we have a compass there with this needle, and he just found it absolutely magical. Like, why, when you get a compass needle, it kind of spins around and points to where the direction of north. It seemed, again, very much like a magic trick to him. And so that was a compass when he was about 4 or 5 years old, so very, very young. And another thing that he asked himself was at the age of 16, he was thinking about light. And he wondered, so maybe a few years older than most of you are, he wondered, what if I ran after a beam of light? So if you have a flashlight, you turn it on, some ways it seems to go basically instantaneously at an infinite speed away from you. But if you actually look closely, it does take some time to move away. And what if I could run fast enough to actually catch up or kind of surf or follow the beam of light, the ray of light, as it's leaving a flashlight? What would you actually see? And that's what Einstein wondered. Because we know that light, it actually takes 8 minutes to come from the sun to Earth. So it does actually take some time. So when you get home at night, you flick the switch on in your room to turn your light on, again, it seems like it's instantaneous. But if you were actually to see it, how it was really happening, then you'd see the bit of the room right next to where the light is we're turning on first, and then the edge would be turning on a split second after that. But if your room was actually as big as the distance from here to the sun, then you could turn the light on, flick the switch in your room, and instantaneously the light bulb would light up, but it would take the light around about 8 minutes to travel to the corner of your room where you might be. So that's another thing that Albert thought of, and that really got him started. So it all started with questions, and we'll see in a minute where those questions led him. But before we go any further, given that the theme is questions, I'd actually like to ask you a few questions. So I actually have a bag here. Some of you may have seen this, but they're called a wind bag. I'd like to ask you how many breaths it would actually take to blow up this. So maybe, actually, would you like to be a volunteer? Okay, great, we've got a volunteer here. And your name is?
Geordie.
Geordie. So if everyone could give Geordie a round of applause here. So you could just blow that up for me, that would be great. It's in the name of science. You know the trick. Okay. So we're counting, that's about four breaths now. Five. Actually, that's very, very impressive. Okay. Actually, if you could just stay up for a minute, Geordie. So what I was going to do, if you actually just try and put your mouth very, very... Did anyone notice anything strange about where Geordie had his mouth positioned while he was blowing up the bag? Yes. Yep. So it was a little bit away from it. Yep. And actually, that's kind of the trick. So have you been inside the Physica Fantastica tent today? Okay, right, and you saw the wind bag. Okay, so if you actually just try and put your mouth very close and blow it up, it's hard work. So it takes about... Did you actually try and do it inside the tent, blowing it up normally? With the wind. Okay, two breaths. Okay, so it normally takes people about 20 or 30 breaths. So it's a lot of hard work. You're really puffed afterwards. But as you saw with Geordie, if you hold your mouth further away, you can actually do it very well. So what we might do is try and blow it up in a single breath using basically the same trick, but I'll need Geordie actually to help me. Great. So if you could just hold it a little bit higher, we'll see if we can use the same trick and actually blow up in a single breath, and thus answering our question, how many breaths does it take to blow it up? So here we go. Okay, if you could just let go. There we have it. Okay, great. So before we wonder why that happened, okay, oops. Geordie, the Toblerone or the translation of Einstein's 1905 photoelectric effect paper? There you go. Thank you very much. So it's 2-0 chocolate against Einstein. So to actually answer that, some of you may have been wondering, why can you actually blow up the windbag with a single breath? And the trick is, it actually goes back to something a Dutch scientist called Mr. Bernoulli said a couple of hundred years ago. And what he said was, if you actually put your mouth just a little bit away, maybe about 10, 15 centimeters away from the mouth of the bag, so you have this kind of gap like here, what you do is, you actually, when you breathe out, you push all the air in the middle of the bag right in front of your mouth away. So it creates kind of a little bit less air, kind of a low pressure right in front of the bag. So there's all this air on the sides and around. And what that does is actually rushes into the bag and goes in and blows up the bag in a single breath. So that's actually called something called Bernoulli's principle. And that actually is thought by many people to help explain why planes fly. So again, it's just something that really started with a question. And it's something that's very fundamental about air, but it has this application to planes and many, many other things. So we'll see kind of that trait and that example and that pattern in a bit more detail. But actually, we might have one more demonstration now. Could I have one volunteer? There's someone up the back there, maybe with a hand up really, really high. Yep, actually you, yes. If you could just come to the horizontal striped T-shirt. So a lot of things in science can seem like magic, but they do actually have an explanation. So to Einstein, the compass seemed like magic to him. And I'll show you another thing which maybe perhaps seemed like magic or an invisible force. So you are?
Jack.
So Jack, could you stand over there? So I know my assistant Beaker, but he's actually very, very shy. And he's very tired too. So, okay. So Jack, if you could stand over there. Right, so Jack, maybe just turn around, face the audience. So I'm going to put this cup on, so you have to stand very, very still. So what I'm going to do is, does anyone know what this is? Yes? Yes? Yep, exactly. And the key word is harmless. So Jack has nothing to worry about here. So you're absolutely right. What it does, tosses over kind of waves of air, sort of pressure of air. And so what I'm attempting to do with this, without even getting any closer to Jack than this, using this kind of magical force of air, this invisible force, which is what's not exactly like the magnet, but it's kind of a similar thing. And there was no actually recorded notes or details of Einstein playing around with an Airzooka but maybe he might have been interested in it. So Jack, I'm going to attempt to knock this cup off. You still? Okay. One more go. Okay. Thank you very much. Really? Okay. Fantastic. So what I would like to go on further with, so that was what Albert was like as a child, as a kid. And Albert the adult, so he'd been questioning and asking all these questions, being incredibly curious like a detective for years and years, and it suddenly all came to a head in 1905 when he was just 20, or he was 26 years of age. And he was actually working, as I said before, approving new inventions and discoveries. So to use a technical term, he was a patent clerk. As I said before, one of the inventions or discoveries he actually kind of ratified or patented was the Toblerone chocolate bar. So that actually is why we've got the Toblerone presence here. So, and actually everything kind of came together, all these questions came together, and they led to ideas, and we'll talk about some of these discoveries that Einstein came up with and made in 1905. Now, some of you, I think a lot of people, when they find out that Einstein was 26 years of age, are a bit kind of surprised at that. So that's actually what he looked like, roughly, in 1905, when he made these discoveries. So I think when most people think of Einstein, they have maybe, there's a picture. Do most of you think of something like that, sort of an old man, gray hair, bad fashion sense, kind of, okay. Well, that's actually what a lot of people think of scientists as being. So maybe we could do a test now to see what you think. So I want everyone to close their eyes. And if you could close your eyes, and I say, picture in your mind what a scientist looks like, what they're wearing, how is their hair neat or messy, do they have a tie, are their shoes cleaned, are they standing up straight, are they slouching, do they have glasses on, do they have a beard, are they male, are they female? So. Now that you've done that, so maybe if I could just get a, what did people visualize? What did, maybe if you could just yell out, what were some of the things that people had? So, old or young? Young? Young. Young. Did anyone get old? Okay. Did your scientist have a beard? No. Neat hair or messy hair? Okay, a few messies there. What were they wearing? A three-piece Italian suit? White lab coat. Did anyone, Did anyone kind of look like, like that there? Hands up if your scientist looked like that. Okay, well, that's quite a few people. And actually, they've done lots and lots of studies exactly asking young people this question. And roughly speaking, people kind of get an answer a bit like that. The mad scientist with the lab coat, middle-aged male, is very prominent. But that's not really true. So I'm a scientist, and I don't look like that. So the interesting thing about math and physics is they're very much studies and fields of study for young people. So if you want a picture of a mathematician or a scientist, that's actually a picture of one. So this is actually comes from a story from Ireland. It's actually a very, very amazing story. That girl's name is Sarah Flannery. At the age of 16 years, not quite in physics, but in mathematics, a very closely related area, she actually made what appeared to be a major, major breakthrough in the study of secret codes or cryptography, all by just being very, very curious, thinking about lots and lots of questions and just being guided by that curiosity and that questioning. And if you actually look at a lot of the big discoveries in physics, they have been made by people in their 20s or maybe early 30s. And very few made by people that are 50, that are 60, and very few that are made by people that look like that. So, let's moving on to Albert the adult, 1905. Let's get into some details of actually what he thought of and some of his discoveries. So was 26 years of old, and these ideas just and questions all came to head and just kind of exploded in his mind. And one question that he was asking himself is, what is light made of? And, but I won't quite ask you that question, but I'll ask you, there are many, many different types of light. Can anyone name a type of light? Yes? Solar, so sun? Exactly. Any other types of light? You've already, yes? Okay, that sounded like light bulb, so that's absolutely correct, an electric light bulb. Can anyone think of maybe other types of light that the people up the back haven't really got some? So what was your type of light?
Ultraviolet.
Ultraviolet light, so kind of like light that maybe came from a laser. Okay, so that definitely is another one, ultraviolet laser light. So there are probably maybe a few other types of light that you could think of, but these are certainly three types of light. And so Albert was thinking about all these types of light and what makes up all of them. And he said that you could actually think of being as being made up of the same thing. And, well, we'll get to what that is in a minute, but, well, he said that you can actually think of them being made up of tiny kind of particles or clumps or little packets of energy. Just think of pure energy. All the lights up there is being made up of these lumps of pure energy called photons. And so he said light is made of these photons. And how he came about that idea was, again from a question that a lot of scientists had had before Albert, and a mystery and a puzzle that no one was able to solve before he got around to it. And a lot of people looked at something where maybe you have a flashlight. You might have a red flashlight up there, and you could get a sheet of metal. So you might have just a sheet or a lump of tin or iron or brass. And so that's kind of what that's representing there. And you might get a really, really bright red flashlight, as bright as you can get, and you can shine it on that piece of metal, and you won't get any effect. Won't be able to make any kind of electricity or current, so you really won't get much of an effect in terms of these millions and millions of electrons, because there are actually a lot of electrons in the metal. They'll just stay in the metal. They won't be sort of knocked out or won't be affected really in any significant way. So a very, very intense beam of red light, even though there's lots and lots of energy there, it doesn't actually do anything. But what scientists found, and they knew this before Albert, that if you actually get a beam of blue light, it could be a very, very faint beam, but you can actually generate some electricity with that. In theory, in practice as well, you can actually get a torch, just a very faint beam of blue light, and you can shine it on a metal, a piece of metal, a lump of iron, and you can actually generate an electrical current. So you can generate electricity, and you'll know, and it's the same kind of electricity you have when you turn on a toaster in the morning, or your computer, or your TV. So in theory, you could actually sort of power a computer if you had the right sort of circuit going with the electricity that you could generate from this sort of very weak beam of blue light. Now, what was the puzzle there was we have all this energy coming from the red beam of light, but a very small amount coming from the blue light. Why is it that the energy, the far less energy in the blue beam is able to generate electricity and power up your computer or some other type of electrical device? And it's all to get to do with photons. So as Albert said, even though there might be billions and billions and lots of photons making up the red light, each one of them is only very weak, is only very feeble. So each one of them is sort of acting in random. There are lots of photons, but they're very, very disorganized. So like a very disorganized crowd. And they're trying to sort of knock these electrons, these other tiny, tiny particles out from the metal here, this sheet of metal. But even though there are millions of them, every one of them is weak, so it doesn't have enough energy or enough oomph to kind of move the electrons out of the way. But even though we have less electrons here in this very, very faint beam, each of them is more energetic. They've got more oomph. They've actually got more sort of buzz. So what they can do is they can actually sort of knock out, and they do knock out some electrons, and you can actually generate electricity there. So what might be kind of like an analogy you could look at is, imagine we have a brick wall. So it's just a wall full of bricks, and we forgot to put the mortar in, so we just have a wall of bricks there. And I've got lots and lots of ping pong balls. So some of you may have seen all the ping pong balls we have in the mousetrap outside in the Physica Fantastica tent. Has anyone seen those? Yep. Well, imagine we have that many ping pong balls, but a million times more. So we had lots, and they're just firing them, hitting against this brick wall. Well, you would find each of those ping pong balls doesn't have much for any, just a tiny little ping pong ball. So none of them by themselves can knock out any of the bricks, so the wall will stay up. But if you could get a baseball, just a few baseballs, which is kind of like the blue light, but each of the pieces making it up is a lot of energy, you can actually knock out, even though you have less baseballs, each one of them has more energy, you can actually knock out some bricks from the wall. And it's kind of like what's happening with the electrons. The bricks being the electrons, the blue light being the baseballs, and the ping pong balls being the red light and the photons. And so that's what Albert Einstein came up with in 1905, and we actually use that today. And that's something, if we want to actually be technical, it's called the photoelectric effect, but that's just a name for it. And actually that's used in digital cameras and in solar cells, really in anywhere or in a lot of places we're actually converting from light. We actually take a photo and converting that and storing that as electricity in some electronic form. So we have a digital camera here. So I just wonder if everyone could smile for a minute. Great. So we're actually using the discovery there at the moment when I took that photo that Einstein came up with. The light is coming in, and what's happening is there are some of that light and energy is being absorbed by electrons inside there, and they're actually being moved along and given enough energy in exactly the same way as what happened here with this process, with the blue light. And so if we kind of look at the pattern that we have, what we have is it all starts with questions. So what makes up light? Comes to the idea, maybe it's made of photons, Albert says. And then the answer, yes, is it is photons. And I should say in between there and there, there was a lot of hard work and effort and calculations and thinking about things in just the right way. And finally, we have the technology, such as digital cameras and solar cells. And so here at Perimeter Institute, we kind of really, like all scientists around the world, we're following exactly the same process that Albert followed. So where do we kind of fit into things? It probably would be the two middle steps here. So we're not really so much about the technologies and the gadgets and so forth, but certainly before you can get any of those, any of the gadgets and computers and MP3 players we take for granted, they all have to start with an idea and with a question and with answers and discoveries, with the concepts. And so what you'll find is, you actually find, if you actually come here, there are a lot of people here working really in these two middle areas here at Perimeter Institute. So this is kind of, in a sense, where we fit in into the process. Something else that Albert thought about was how fast light travels. Now, light travels really fast. Now, when I'm saying fast, I mean really, really, really fast. It's so fast that it's probably something so fast that it could actually circle the entire globe 7 times per second. And it's also so fast that it's maybe about a million times faster than what a plane, a Boeing 747, flies at. So it goes at incredibly, incredibly quickly. And what Einstein thought about, light actually started thinking about space and time and distance and length and these fundamental things that are all around us. Every second of the day, every second we're awake, we're aware of time. Just because morning comes and then midday and then the afternoon. And also at space, we're always somewhere. We're always at school, at our friend's house, away from school. So space and time are around us everywhere. And Albert's made some amazing discoveries and that they seem to act in very, very strange ways. And so it's kind of hard to explain some of these ways, and because they come related to something called his theory of relativity. But what we can do is We can't actually travel at the speed of light or close to the speed of light because that is very, very difficult to do. It would take lots and lots of energy. And on Earth, we can only get tiny, tiny particles can do that. But just if we were talking about flying and flight, I might have a flight simulator that I could show you what it is like to actually fly a plane. Well, here I have, it's kind of like an Einstein simulator. And this simulates exactly what you would see if you were traveling close to the speed of light, according to Albert. So we actually have a roller coaster ride traveling at, I think it's 99% of the speed of light. Does anyone like roller coaster rides? Okay, good, just checking. I was a bit worried about after the Einstein. So we'll start that now. And this is through Einstein's eyes. And this actually uses some of the discoveries that Albert made, started with some of his questions. So we'll... So what you will see is, you actually see straight objects, the railings of the roller coaster appearing bent. See if you can look out and find those. The colors will also kind of change and warp around. And just generally, it will seem like some kind of a weird dream. So I have to press play. Again, we're going about 99% of the speed of light. We're going very quickly. You notice the actual railings on the left and the right, from below and above, they're actually straight. But it's just, we're traveling so fast that space it actually gets distorted. We're about to go on a loop now. There's actually sort of a lot of complicated physics and ideas behind these, which we can't really go through, but the basic idea, again, is just that when you travel really fast, space and time get distorted, as I was saying. They'll get sort of warped and bent out of shape, and time slows down, and things actually shrink. Okay. Okay, would anyone like to see another one? Okay, yeah. So we'll go for a... Should go on a tram ride. So they have some trams in Toronto. So we'll go on a tram ride. This is at 87% of the speed of light. So this again, I mean, this is really fast. So this is again so fast you'd be going around the entire Earth about six times per second. And one thing the tram actually does, it actually shrinks as it goes past. See the shadow appears to be kind of bent as well. You can notice the tram seems to shrink down, sort of contract. You probably haven't seen any of these effects in daily life because trams normally don't move that fast. But even though you don't see those strange effects, Even though you don't see those strange effects, you can actually see a lot of other strange effects. And just to prove that to you, I actually have two more demonstrations I'd like to go through. And this is actually where Beaker, my assistant, will come in handy. So I'll need one more volunteer for that. Maybe someone, actually you with the red hat on, if you could come out, please. And Your name is?
Annalise.
Damien? Damien. Bika? Annalise. Okay, great. So if you could just come over here, Annalise. So just put this, maybe we'll put this up on the table here. And let's put Bika here. So, okay, so hopefully everyone. So what we're actually, we're going to do, just to show you, they're very, very strange things. And so what I have is, I have a cup of water. Well, I'll put some water in that, 2 cups. So maybe if we do this together, how does that sound? Great. So we'll just fill up the 2 cups of water there. So what we're going to attempt to do is to put these cups of water upside down without spilling any water. Do you think we can do that? Okay, probably. Okay, that's good. I like the attitude. Okay. So we have pieces of cardboard. So what you'll need to do is just put it on there and just hold it very kind of tight and flat. So kind of push down and flat. That makes sense? Great. So maybe I might go over here. And so what we're going to do, so if you could hold that, maybe I'll do it first, and then how's that sound? And you could follow after me. So what we'll get this cup here, and I'll just turn it upside down, and I'm actually going to put it over the top of Bika because I trust that this will work, and Bika won't get a drop spilt on him. So hopefully Bika won't get. Oops. Yeah. Well, so we'll see how it goes. Okay. So 1, 2. Oops. Okay. Maybe we'll try your cup. Yeah. Okay. So the interesting thing about science is experiments don't always work. So maybe yeah. So you know what to do? So if you could maybe flip that over. I mean, I think you might have to hold it tight. Can you just really like push? Oops. Okay. So shall I try it and first, and we'll see how it goes. And maybe you can try it afterwards. So how's that sound? So I think I think this one's better. So here we go. Now would you like to maybe have a go? How's that? You know what to do? Okay, great. Now don't get Bika wet. Okay. Wow. Thank you very much. Now, I'm all out of Albert Einstein papers, but I could either mail you a copy to home, or you can have this Toblerone bar. Okay. There you go. Thank you very much, Annalise. So I have one last demonstration, and this is actually a demonstration of how a single sheet of newspaper is stronger than a ruler. So I have a 30-centimeter ruler and a single sheet of newspaper. And you might expect the ruler to be stronger, but I'm actually going to show you the newspaper is stronger. I'm going to break this ruler with a single sheet of newspaper. So let's get everything set up. Out. Move this back a bit. Okay. What I'm going to do is, so I have the ruler here, just lay half on the table, half off, get the single sheet of paper, put it there. I'm actually going to do a karate chop down. And, well, actually, I should say, so if I just have the ruler there and I do a karate chop, what do you think will happen to the ruler? Yes. In the third row, in the red T-shirt, it'll fling. Okay, it flings. Okay, that's good. Should we do it one more time just to check? That's fling. Okay. So if we put this ruler down here, and we put this single sheet of paper on it, what do you think will happen? Okay, let's. Do you have an idea?
It goes down the table.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go up, yeah.
So the newspaper will break?
Maybe.
Maybe, okay. So we'll see. Maybe should we do the experiment, see how we go? How does that sound? Okay. So certainly a lot of people think that the newspaper, how many people think the newspaper will break? Okay, a few people. Okay. What do the other people think will happen? You think this flimsy sheet of newspaper is going to hold down this stick? Okay, well, maybe we'll do the experiment and we'll see what happens. Obviously, we have a very smart audience here. Have to get new tricks next year. Okay, so let's see how we go. Okay. Oops. Okay. All right. Okay, so we'll try that one more time. That wasn't meant to happen. Okay. Okay. So, that's all right. Okay, so one more time. And we'll see if we can actually get this to break. Okay. That was better. So we have a very, very, very smart audience here, but for a lot of other people, that is actually very, very surprising, that just a single mere sheet of newspaper can break a ruler. So the reason it does that, again, there are a lot of demonstrations here with air and air pressure. And the reason that works is that there's all this air, invisible air all around us. We're breathing it in all the time. And there's actually a lot of air pushing down air pressure over the area of the newspaper. And so there's all this air pushing down. And so that's equivalent to a person kind of really holding their hands and pushing them down. So it creates a really, really sort of strong presence and a strong force actually pushing the newspaper down. It's enough to hold down the side of the ruler on the table so that basically the ruler gives and it can actually break. So to many people, that's actually very surprising. So it's another surprising thing related to just as Albert and the discoveries he made about space and time, the way they warp and bend and twist, were very, very surprising back then. But moving along, so you might wonder, well, those ideas, sure, we have a roller coaster moving at 99% of the speed of light, and the tram bending and warping and shrinking, but how is that relevant? How is actually impact on us to us today? And it's actually relevant because there's something called the global positioning system. Has anyone heard of that? Okay, great. You have. Fantastic, fantastic. Yep, basically, yeah. So there's actually a network of 24 satellites orbiting 20,000 kilometers above the Earth. And they're actually continually sending out information and signals to people. And if you have a GPS receiver, and planes have them and they use them to land, taxi drivers have them, they use them with satellite navigation to find out where to take their customers home. Emergency services vehicles have them, hikers have them when you can even get them at schools and buy them for about $100. So a lot of people have these devices, and just as those satellites are up there, they're continually sending out signals. And if you get a whole bunch of signals from three or four different satellites, then you can actually figure out, well, you're so far away from one satellite and so far away from another. So you can kind of like sort of join the dots and actually sort of figure out where you are by looking at where these kind of lines from satellites intersect, just as you can find out where you are using a street directory or which has a grid on it by sort of going along so many spaces or grid lines and then going down so many grid lines, you can find out where you are. It's kind of a similar sort of thing with these satellites. And the interesting thing is they actually use Albert's theory of relativity and some of the discoveries that he made in 1905 and a little bit after that with another of his theories. But certainly that these satellites, so they're 20,000 kilometers up in space, so they're kind of far away. And Albert actually said that time just passes a little bit differently out there, and time actually goes a little bit more quickly And so for us, if we were able to watch sort of someone, if they were actually a space person, was out there right near where these satellites were, then to us they'd kind of seem like they were in slightly slow, fast motion. Like in a fast motion movie, their time would be going a little bit more quickly. And to actually find out where you are, you actually need to factor and take that into account. Otherwise, you'll actually be off by, even though it's a very, very small effect with time difference, it's just a split fraction of a second, that actually has some, it's enough just to completely throw the system off. And because even in a split fraction of a second, light that goes very, very fast can travel hundreds of meters or kilometers. And as a result, if you actually were using one of these GPS devices, if you got in a taxi and it was using one of these GPS devices and it was not using Albert's theories, you try to get home, you could end up at school or your friend's house, or you'd end up kilometers away from where you wanted to go. So this is one area, and we can again see the same kind of pattern, that it's really started with these questions. And it started again with the question Albert had when he was 16 years old. He was still in school. And what would happen if you ran alongside a beam of light coming out of a flashlight? And it led to his ideas and a lot of thinking, and really 10 years of thinking. And what that led to were answers and discoveries about space and time. And some of those you can actually see in the movies and the simulations that we had, as his theory of relativity. And eventually, 100 years from that, those ideas have been fed into the technology, into the global positioning system. Because once you understand a lot of things about the fundamental nature, about light, about air, about space, and about time, then you kind of have this, you have this extra understanding, you can kind of mold the world and use it to your advantage in so many ways, for example, with the digital camera and the global positioning system. Finally, a third question that Albert was asking himself at the age of 26 was, what are atoms made of? So we can actually, we all know today that the clothes you're wearing, the seats you're sitting on, the bicycles you ride, your bed at home, all made of tiny, tiny invisible particles called atoms. And they're like the tiny building blocks or Lego blocks or Lego blocks that basically make up all objects in the world. And this question that Albert asked helped him to lead to a number of great discoveries. So atoms, they're actually, we all know that they exist, but they're very, very hard to visualize. They're about a million times smaller than a grain of sand or a grain of dirt. And that's very, very hard to get a picture. I find it difficult to get a picture of that in my mind. So to help you with that, I've actually brought in some grains of dirt, and I'm going to pass them around. But we actually have, this festival goes for 3 weeks, right? We'll need them back at the end. So maybe if you could just take that there. Great. So if you could just take a couple of those. Could you hand out, please? You can see them. If you could just take a couple of those, pass them on. And could you just put your hand out, please? Great. Could you just put your hand out, please? Great. Okay. So while you're actually passing them around and hanging them around, could you just try and imagine something about a million times smaller than that? And if you can, that's about the size of an atom. Are they going around? They're going. Okay, that's fine. Okay. So just whoever's the last person, could you just bring them back at the end? That would be great. And I did actually count them, so I know how many there are. So what Albert was doing was, imagine 100 years ago, a lot of people had an idea about atom and thought that, well, maybe they exist. But they weren't sure. There was no actual strong evidence. And certainly people couldn't see atoms. Not like you can just look at them and see them, even with very, very powerful microscopes that they had back then. No one could see atoms. And what Albert did was, in a very indirect way, but a very, very clever way, he came up with a crucial idea about proving that atoms were real. And the way he did it, you may have seen a demonstration out there, it's related to Brownian motion. And if you can actually get, there's just some milk. So I've just gotten some milk out of a fridge, just mixed it with some water, so we have just some very, very dilute milk. And if you actually look under a microscope at that milk, there are tiny particles of fat, sort of moving around. And if you look at how they appear underneath the microscope, they actually kind of jiggle around and move in sort of a random fashion. Somewhere they go this way, somewhere they go that way, up, down. And people had known about this for a number of years, but again, like the effect with light, it was actually very much a mystery to people. No one really understood what was happening. And it was Albert that solved the mystery. And he said that you have these large particles of fat that may be thousands of times larger or even more than a tiny, tiny atom, but there are millions of invisible atoms actually around in the water or water molecules. And sometimes the water molecule is hitting this fat particle from this side, sometimes from below, sometimes from above, and from all kinds of directions, they're just being continually bombarded. And so they move in this sort of random zigzagging, jiggly pattern. And the reason why is because they're being moved by atoms. And so that, again, was a really good reason to believe in atoms, because they were having this effect even though you couldn't see them. He could explain what you could see by guessing or thinking that atoms were real. And that was a very, very important thing, because 3 years after that, a French scientist, Jean Perrin, actually did an experiment. And that experiment provided very conclusive proof, convinced a lot of people that atoms were real. And that actually the scientist that did that experiment won the Nobel Prize in 1926 for that experiment. So we have Einstein to thank just for the knowing about these atoms that make up almost everything around us. And the interesting thing is, maybe this might not be the best example, but the actual discovery that Einstein made with how these atoms kind of move, or these particles move and jiggle around in this random motion, that's actually used by people to make money on the stock market. And with money, they could buy millions of Toblerone bars or whatever they want to buy. So again, it's another example where we have this sort of questioning, what is everything made of? What are the things that make up all the clothes and every other objects? And the idea was perhaps it's atoms. And then Einstein helped very much in this next step, getting from the answers and just to the discoveries to atoms, and then the application of the stock market to making money, and many, many other applications as well. And so just to give you an idea, maybe if you try and visualize Brownian motion in your mind, imagine I have a room that has a basketball in it. And a bit like the mousetrap outside, we have a million, again, ping pong balls. And they're just hitting it from all sides, up and down, and they're just randomly bombarding it. Well, what the basketball will do in the middle will move a bit this way, a bit that way, up and down. It will move in a very random, haphazard, jiggling manner. And that's exactly what Einstein said was the explanation for why the fat particles or larger particles actually moved in the sort of the random way they do. And that's another example. So this kind of brings me to near the end of the talk. And so what I've tried to get across is that Albert, it really started with questions. He was just a curious person. He just kept questioning. And one thing he said himself was, a lot of people, sort of adults, bigger people, sort of stop asking certain questions. But he didn't. He just kept on going and kept on asking the sort of questions that a child would. And a lot of the questions and ideas and theories that really helped kickstart all these discoveries that we're hearing about were reasonably simple ideas and pictures. Another one was just an example of what he would feel if we fell off his chair. Actually was unlucky enough for it to fall backwards and he fell down. It would feel like he would be weightless, just falling down. And that helped him with another of his big theories. And so really science and a lot of things start with questions. And so what I would like each and every child here today to do would be just to go home and keep asking your parents questions like, why does this work? Why does that work? And to never, never stop and always continually do that. Okay. And so you can be a scientist. Is that all right, parents, mum and dad? Okay, great. Okay. And this quote from Albert, with curiosity and questions that go hand in hand, is the important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. So with that, I guess I'd like to end and just say, science physics and a lot of things at Perimeter Institute and Einstein, it all starts with questions and an attitude. Why does this happen? Why does that happen? And not always, but sometimes it can lead you to fantastic ideas and eventually to technologies. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much, Damien. We're going to bring up the house lights now and bring some microphones down. And this is your opportunity, if you have any questions about what you've heard or anything you've seen at the Institute today, to just raise your hand and we will pass the microphone to you. No question is too big or too little. Okay, microphone to the center. Just run one right to the middle, please.
Should we, is it Louis?
Sure. Go ahead.
We've got a...
How many people believed Einstein when he was saying about the atoms?
Like, did many people believe him? So yeah. Did many people believe Einstein when he first came up with his idea about atoms? It took a while for people to understand what he was saying, and so a number of people did, not everyone did. So it was kind of half and half in a way. So some people that didn't believe in atoms, that were still skeptical, they weren't actually convinced by Einstein's ideas, because at that stage they were just ideas. He just had this theory about atoms, and it wasn't until he was really a thinker. He didn't actually do many experiments. It was only 3 years later when someone did the experiment, the exact experiment that Albert Einstein said to do, and then that convinced everyone. So when Einstein's idea came out, it convinced some people, but some people were skeptical. And that illustrates that in physics and in science in general, that experiments are very important, because we can come up with ideas, but we can test them, and we can find out whether they're right or wrong. So it was a bit of both. Yes, there's a question.
Question over here.
Or can we get a...
Oh, sure.
We'll get the mic down to the front. Where's...
We have a question.
Oh, okay.
Can you crush water?
Can you crush water? Well, it's kind of... Depends how hard you push, is the answer. Water is reasonably incompressible. So if you don't push too hard, then it's hard to actually compress. But again, if you push hard enough, you can actually crush it and actually increase the pressure. Because one thing that does, if you've ever seen pictures of TV with the people that go in submarines or dive deep down to the bottom of the ocean, if they're scuba divers, down there the water's actually higher pressure. So the water is actually being crushed by all the water above, all the weight of the water above. So it's actually higher pressure. And that's why, have you ever had your ears kind of pop, or kind of you feel the pressure when you're going down? That's because all the weight of the water above is sort of pushing down and crushing, in a sense, the water below. So that's why that happens. It's pushing harder on your ears. So the answer is, you can. Yes?
Why are atoms so small?
Why are atoms so small? I don't know. I don't know. I mean when the universe was made, mate, they could have been as big as basketballs. All I can say is if atoms were the size of basketballs or baseballs, then the world would be a very different place. But, yeah, that's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that. And there are a lot of questions that, there are a lot of questions in science and in physics that we still don't know the answer to. And almost certainly there's more that we don't know about the universe than what we do know. Certainly there's a lot of things about stars and the planets, how the universe began, that we don't know. And things about atoms, why are things made of atoms? Why aren't things made of tiny little chocolate bars or shadows or weird knots? Why is it atoms? You know, we don't know, but certainly we're trying. So I'm sorry, I'm not sure what to say to that. But when you find the answer, let me know. Yes.
You haven't explained how it warps time and space, like how traveling at a speed of light warps space and time, and you haven't told us how when you're closer to a big, massive body, that time slows down.
So first of all, you're absolutely right. My apologies for not doing that. I'm happy to give you very quick answers now, and I'm welcome to talk to me afterwards, or even go along to any of the adult lectures. They'll probably have some more explanations. But to take the second question first, the second comment, one other thing you said that I didn't explain, that objects and matter actually slow down time. So that again gets onto a profound idea I didn't really touch on that came in 1915. But Albert said that actually big objects like the sun, the earth, and even something smaller like a bowling ball, they actually slow down time. So gravity actually slows down time. And the stronger the gravity, the slower time goes. So that if you were basically to take a spaceship to Jupiter, Jupiter's a bigger planet, it actually has a stronger gravity. Time would actually go more slowly there. And if you didn't mind the fact that there was no oxygen and it was very, very cold in Jupiter, you could actually live for longer, just by a split fraction of a second. But you actually live for longer, and time would actually be slower on Earth. And so the reason Einstein said was that gravity was actually doing that. So in terms of why time and space are actually warped, that gets onto his theory of relativity. But really, one reason he said was that actually when we're moving, time and space kind of get mixed up with each other. And that's actually one of the reasons why. So kind of some time gets diverted or changed into space. And so perhaps that's one, so sort of less time around, so time moves more slowly. So there's kind of leaving out a lot of details there. But that's actually, people take whole university courses to find the answer to the question you just asked. So it's an excellent question. I think that's the best answer I can give.
Wasn't it Dalton who originally developed the atomic theory?
Sorry?
Wasn't it Dalton? He originally developed the atomic theory.
I believe it was. So Dalton, a couple of years, maybe a century or two, or certainly many years before Einstein. So I think he was, the idea of actually atoms, that everything is made up of these indivisible chunks or tiny things, actually goes back to 500 years BC, or 2,500 years, probably at least 500 years BC, back to people, philosophers, Democritus and Leucippus, actually the ancient Greece. They even back then had the idea. But certainly in modern times, Dalton was one person that reinvigorated it. So people had the idea for atoms, but not everyone believed them because they were just an idea then. They couldn't see them. And if you were to go to Dalton and say, can you show me that atoms were real, then he couldn't have come up with any conclusive argument. So that's why some scientists believed them around about Einstein's times and some didn't. But Einstein really, he kind of was one that nailed it for atoms and said, look, do this experiment. This will prove beyond a doubt that atoms are real. So definitely, and this really illustrates that in science, a lot of things are very incremental, and that's Einstein definitely built on the work of Dalton, and just as all the scientists here at Perimeter Institute are building on Einstein's research and everyone else, every other scientist around the world today or physicist is.
What's faster, the speed of light or the speed of darkness?
What's faster, the speed of light or the speed of darkness? Well, I guess, maybe, but they'd be the same because darkness is like the absence of light. So maybe if you have to get an area dark, then light has to move away from it. But if light's moving away from it, then light moves away at the speed of light. So that darkness might actually be the speed. Although often, scientists don't really talk about what the speed of darkness is, because we think that light's a thing, but we don't think darkness is actually a thing in itself. So we think it's like the speed of light. So we think that light is actually something. So did you mean something like what's the speed of a shadow or how fast shadows can move because they're like a dark region? So what's light or darkness? Well, if you think of darkness as being just the absence of light and an area becomes dark because light is moving away from it, then I think they'd probably have the same speed because something can only become dark if something light's moving away from it. But having said that, you can actually get some strange effects with shadows moving at very, very high speeds, but even actually faster than the speed of light, but that's something else. Yes?
How old was he when he died?
Sorry?
How old was Einstein when he died?
How old was Einstein? He was born in 1879, and so he died in 1955. So I think he was 76 years old. So, yeah. We've got another question. Is anyone for microphone? Yep.
Since you said that when you go faster, time goes slower.
Yep.
Then you can only go back in time. How do you go forward? Like, if they really invent one, can you just go back and then not go forward?
Can you go back in time?
Yeah.
No, not with that. The effect I was talking about. You always go forward in time. You go more slowly. But you're always going forward in time. It's never the time goes backwards, so you become younger, or you go back to next week or the day before. So you're always, with that effect, you're always going forward in time. So people have talked about very weird ways you might be able to use some of Albert theories to go backwards in time, but they're very, very, very speculative. So most people would probably say you can only go forward in time.
One last question.
Yep.
Why does gravity make it seem like everything's, like, we're standing straight up when we're actually sort of sticking out right to the side of the Earth?
Sorry, I couldn't...
Gravity sort of makes it like you're sticking straight up when you're actually going sideways out of the Earth. Why is that?
I come from Australia and that's kind of upside down. And so the people there, do you mean the people there, they don't feel like they're upside down? So why don't people in Australia feel like they're upside down?
No, not that, because like we're sticking out of the side of the Earth, but it seems like we're going straight up. Why?
Why? Well, yep, excellent question. I guess one of the reasons is that even though if we were to go into outer space, you can see photos of the Earth that astronauts have taken, the Earth seems like the Earth is curved like a really, really big ball, but as just looking out into the horizon, if you go into the countryside, you can see a field, it pretty much looks like it's flat. That's because it's just curving very, very, very slowly and very, very gently. So as far as we're concerned, just on our scale, it looks like it's flat. And what determines whether we're standing up or whether we're lying on our side or everyone's kind of walking around like this is just gravity. And that's basically pushing us towards the center of the Earth. So it's pushing us down here. So this kind of part around us, as far as we can see, or we're concerned, it's flat. So it's just like something that's pulling us down. And even people in Australia, and I know this because I've been to Australia, that it's kind of upside down from our perspective. From theirs, it looks very flat. And again, gravity's sort of all pulling towards the middle of the Earth. So everyone's getting pulled towards the center. And their little part sort of seems like flat. So it is. I guess from their perspective, it seems like everything's the right way up.
I could tell that some people are itching to have to get up and move on a little bit. So how about we wrap up this formal part of the Q&A? If you have any questions left, and there's a few of you here, come on down and Damien can stay mm-hmm. with you for a few more minutes. And for the rest of you, we still have the two floors of exhibits open. There's refreshments in the bistro. And we'll just remind everybody to exit on the far right-hand door at the top of the theater. Thank you very much.